Love, VOA1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Katie Weaver reports on malnutrition among children in Ecuador. Brian Lynn tells us about a scientific breakthrough in this week's technology report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
Erwin Ronquillo, an official with the government program Ecuador Grows Without Malnutrition, is worried about hunger in his country. Ronquillo said child malnutrition is chronic among Ecuador's population. It is seen everywhere, but hits hardest in rural areas and among the country's native peoples, he said. The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, keeps information related to children and their development for countries around the world. UNICEF information suggests that 1 in 3 Ecuadorian children suffers from malnutrition. Of those, about 41% are native. Nayeri Espinoza is a mother whose partner left her. She lives in a neighborhood of the capital city, Quito, called Pisuli. She said her children, who are 8 and 4 years old, do not usually eat meat. Both children appear to be younger because of their height and the thinness of the youngest girl. Sometimes the family buys chicken, but not often, Espinoza said. It is difficult to get any job as a domestic worker, worse after the pandemic, she said. Monica Cabrera is with the Ministry of Economic and Social Inclusion. She works in the Comal Metropolitano neighborhood on the southern edge of Quito. It is a high-risk area. Cabrera has been robbed several times there. She visits the homes of at least 25 young mothers. Two of the mothers are minors, 15 and 17 years old. Her job is to support the group of mothers while they are pregnant until their children reach 1 year of age. Cabrera said the poorest people in the city are usually native migrants from rural areas. They try to earn a living by selling waste materials, making building materials, or selling products on the streets. Those who have more have the luxury of eating twice a day, Cabrera said. She said she knows of families that eat only once a day, and sometimes not even that. UNICEF's numbers suggest that 50% of Ecuadorian households with children had difficulty getting the necessary food in 2021 because of the pandemic. As a result, 27% of children had their development affected because of chronic malnutrition, the agency said. In addition, 72% of children lacked basic services for development, such as health and education, UNICEF said. Ecuador's government is led by President Guillermo Lasso, a former banker. The government has pledged to fight chronic malnutrition. It has promised to spend $350 million a year to improve health, family, education, and support services. Tania Herrera lives with her parents and has a baby, Sara Milena. Herrera receives a $50 monthly stipend from the government to support the baby. To receive that money, she promised to join all child support activities that she is asked to attend. Her parents currently support the family. They earn between $5 and $7 a day. That amount must feed 5 adults. It also must serve to support the new arrival. The adults hope to eat something twice a day. The family has lived in Quito for several years. They can only pay for chicken meat from time to time. The baby is breastfed. I'm Katie Weaver.
American scientists have announced a major scientific breakthrough in the long-sought search for a way to use nuclear fusion to produce energy. The announcement came Tuesday during a briefing by U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm and other officials in Washington, D.C. Granholm said that for the first time, a fusion reaction experiment had produced more energy than was required to ignite it. Scientists describe such a result as net energy gain. This state has until now been an unreachable goal for the scientists because fusion happens at extremely high temperatures and pressures. This makes the process very difficult to control. The new result came last week during an experiment carried out by government scientists at the National Ignition Facility at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. The lab is part of the U.S. Department of Energy. Fusion happens when the nuclei of two atoms are subjected to extreme heat. This leads to the formation of a new, larger atom and the release of energy. Fusion is the process that fuels stars, including the sun. Scientists have long understood how nuclear fusion works. Many have tried to repeat the process on Earth. The current efforts centered on fusing a pair of hydrogen isotopes, deuterium and tritium. The Department of Energy says that the combination releases much more energy than most fusion reactions. It also requires less heat to do so. Some experts have suggested that fusion energy could one day be used to provide limitless, pollution-free power. Granholm and other officials said Tuesday that the latest result is a major step forward in helping to create a future source for clean power generation. However, they said commercialization of the technology will likely take many years to be fully developed. Granholm said the department's ignition success permits scientists for the first time to copy certain conditions that are found only in the stars and the sun. She added that the result is a major step toward the possibility of zero-carbon abundant fusion energy powering our society. The experiments involved aiming nearly 200 lasers at a small capsule that contained fuel. When the lasers ignited the fuel, two lighter atoms were joined together to create a denser one. This process produced more energy than was required to ignite it, the scientists said. The experiment briefly reached fusion ignition by generating 3.15 megajoules of energy output. This was after the laser targeting the capsule used 2.05 megajoules of energy, the energy department said. A megajoule is a measurement for energy output. Nuclear scientists not involved in the latest result praised the success as a major breakthrough. But they noted there is much more science to be done before fusion can develop into a profitable industry. Ricardo Betti is a professor at New York's University of Rochester and an expert in laser fusion. He compared the latest result to when humans first learned that refining oil into gasoline and igniting it could produce an explosion. "You still don't have the engine, and you still don't have the tires," Betty said. "You can't say that you have a car." Tony Rulstone is a nuclear energy expert at the University of Cambridge in Britain. He told Reuters news agency that while interesting, the latest experiment still leaves scientists a long way from turning the process into useful, limitless energy. Rulstone said that in order to become commercially successful, a power plant would have to produce enough energy to also power the laser equipment and generate a continuous ignition process. I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn joins me to talk about a few terms that you heard in today's technology report. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you, Ashley. Glad to be here.
Your report deals with American scientists announcing a major advance related to nuclear fusion technology. I noticed your story has some words in it that are often used by people or organizations to describe major new developments or inventions. What are those words?
Yes, Ashley, the story includes the words breakthrough and milestone. The two are kind of related but do have separate meanings. Breakthrough is defined as a development or discovery that happens suddenly and is very unusual. The scientists were describing today's news as a breakthrough because the fusion process that was carried out had never happened before.
Okay, and what about milestone? Is this also used to describe a momentous, possibly historic event?
Not in the same way, actually. So the basic definition of milestone is an important event in the history or development of something. In English, breakthrough seems to hold more weight and could even be something historic, but we would use milestone to describe a certain stage of process in the development of something bigger. Then, when that something bigger actually becomes a reality, we could likely identify it at that time as a breakthrough.
Thanks for that explanation, Brian. Both words seem to come up a lot in scientific and technology stories, since those areas are always progressing and producing new discoveries.
Yes, that is correct. So our listeners can expect to keep hearing them again and again.
Thanks for joining me on the program, Brian.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ashley.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. South Carolina withdrew from the United States on December 20th, 1860. The state seceded because a Republican, Abraham Lincoln, had been elected president. The Republicans were a new party, and Lincoln was the first to be elected president. They wanted to stop slavery from spreading into the Western territories. Southern states believed they had a constitutional right to take property, including slaves, anywhere. They also feared that any interference with slavery would end their way of life. Frank Oliver and Larry West tell what happened after South Carolina left the Union.
South Carolina faced several problems after it seceded. The most serious problem was what to do with property owned by the federal government. There were several United States forts in and around the port of Charleston. Fort Moultrie had fewer than 70 soldiers. Castle Pinckney had only one. And Fort Sumter, which was still being built, had none. The commander of the forts asked for more men. Without them, he said, he could not defend the forts. The army refused. It told the commander to defend the forts as best he could. He was told to do nothing that might cause South Carolina to attack. If South Carolina attacked or planned to attack, then he could move his men into the fort that would be easiest to defend. That would probably be the new one, Fort Sumter.
The governor of South Carolina planned to stop any movement of federal troops. He ordered state soldiers to stop every boat in Charleston Harbor. They were to permit no United States troops to reach Fort Sumter. If any boat carrying troops refused to stop, the state soldiers were to sink it and seize the fort. 6 days after South Carolina seceded from the Union, the commander of Charleston's forts decided to move his men to Fort Sumter. They would move as soon as it was dark. The federal troops crossed the port in small boats. The state soldiers did not see them. The governor was furious when he learned what had happened. He demanded that the federal troops leave Fort Sumter. The commander said they would stay. The governor then ordered state soldiers to seize the other two forts in Charleston Harbor. And he ordered the state flag raised over all other federal property in the city.
President James Buchanan, who would leave office in just a few months, was forced to deal with the situation. His cabinet was deeply divided on the issue. The Southerners wanted him to recognize South Carolina and order all federal troops out of Charleston Harbor. The Northerners said he must not give up any federal property or rights. The president agreed to meet with three representatives from South Carolina. They had come to Washington to negotiate the future of federal property in their state. The attorney general said the meeting was a mistake. These gentlemen, he said, claim to be ambassadors of South Carolina. This is foolish. They cannot be ambassadors. They are lawbreakers, traitors, and should be arrested. You cannot negotiate with them.
The Attorney General and the Secretary of State threatened to resign if President Buchanan gave in to South Carolina's demands. The president finally agreed not to give in. He said he would keep federal troops in Charleston Harbor. And he said Fort Sumter would be defended against all hostile action. On the last day of 1860, he ordered 200 troops and extra supplies sent to Fort Sumter. The War Department wanted to keep the operation secret. So the troops and supplies were put on a fast civilian ship instead of a slower warship. It was thought that a civilian ship could get into Charleston Harbor before state forces could act. But a Southern senator learned of the operation. He warned the governor of South Carolina. When the ship arrived in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina soldiers were waiting.
The soldiers lit a cannon and fired a warning shot. The ship refused to stop. Other cannons then opened fire. The commander of federal troops at Fort Sumter had a difficult decision to make. He had received permission to defend the fort if attacked, but his orders said nothing about defending ships. He knew that if he opened fire, the United States and South Carolina would be at war. The decision was made for him. South Carolina's cannons finally hit the ship. The ship slowed, then turned back to sea. It returned north with all the troops and supplies.
The commander of Fort Sumter sent a message to the governor of South Carolina. "Your forces," he wrote, "fired this morning on a civilian ship flying the flag of my government. Since I have not been informed that South Carolina declared war on the United States, I can only believe that this hostile act was done without your knowledge or permission. For this reason, and only this, I did not fire on your guns." If, the commander said, the governor had approved the shelling, it would be an act of war, and he would be forced to close the port of Charleston. No ship would be permitted to enter or leave. The governor's answer came back within hours. He said South Carolina was now independent. He said the attempt by the United States to strengthen its force at Fort Sumter was clearly an act of aggression, and he demanded that the commander surrender.
During the crisis over Fort Sumter, Congress tried to find a compromise that might prevent war. Lawmakers proposed a new line across the country. South of the line, slavery would be permitted. North of the line, slavery would be illegal. Many Republicans supported the proposal, even though the Republican Party opposed the spread of slavery into the Western territories. One Republican, however, rejected the idea completely. He was Abraham Lincoln, who would take office as president in March. Lincoln said there could be no compromise on extending slavery. If there is, he said, then all our hard work is lost. If trouble comes, it is better to let it come now than at some later time.
The trouble would come soon. One by one, the states of the South seceded. By February 1st, 1861, six states had followed South Carolina out of the Union. A few days later, representatives from the states met in Montgomery, Alabama. Their job was to create a new nation. It would be an independent republic called the Confederate States of America. The convention approved a constitution for the new nation. The document was like the Constitution of the United States, but with major changes. The Southern Constitution gave greater importance to the rights of states, and it said there could be no laws against slavery. The convention named former United States Senator Jefferson Davis to be president of the Confederate States of America. Davis did not want civil war, but he was not afraid of it. He said, "Our separation from the old Union is complete. The time for compromise has passed. Should others try to change our decision with force, they will smell Southern gunpowder and feel the steel of Southern swords."
Jefferson Davis left his farm in Mississippi to become president of the Confederate States of America on February 11th. On that same day, Abraham Lincoln left his home in Illinois to become president of the United States. As Lincoln got on the train that would take him to Washington, he said, "I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return. The task before me is greater than that which rested upon our first president. Without the help of God, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Let us hope that all yet will be well."
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.